It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
If you wanted to meet with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, you had to pay for it, and a lot of people did.
They're essentially saying to their foreign donors that they can make a down payment on Clinton access in the next administration.
It is something that they set up in order to preserve their status in the world with world leaders taking foreign money.
It demonstrates incredibly poor judgment.
Hillary Clinton should shut down the Clinton Foundation right now. Now,
it's impossible to tell where the Clinton Foundation ends and the State Department begins.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you live and in the chair, and very grateful to be back healthy and in one piece. Enjoyed my wonderful time with my grandchildren up in British Columbia. But while I was gone, of course, the world moves on. And I think that was one of the biggest stories of last week. The AP reporting that at least 85 of 154 people representing private interests had in-person meetings with Mrs. Clinton. 85 of them gave as much as $156 million to the Clinton Foundation. That is astounding. And that's it. The AP said that didn't even include individuals from foreign countries who met with Clinton when she was Secretary of State. They calculated that those governments, 16 of them, donated up to $170 million to the Clinton Foundation. What does that mean? Well, that means that if Mrs. Clinton, as a Secretary of State, was indeed, and honestly, given the reporting, and even what the friendly sources to Mrs. Clinton are reporting, how could you not conclude that she was trading access to the State Department for favors, for money, for her personal family foundation, upon which the family draws money? They do their travel. It's kind of like their personal piggy bank. And, of course, they pretend as though they're doing humanitarian efforts. You know, there was such a scandal when the earthquake hit Haiti, and so much of the Clinton Foundation money was supposed to go down there, and it was not. It didn't go. It didn't get there. So that's a huge scandal, and that's just one incident that we know about. So this was a very big thing for the AP to report that there so many of these donors gave money, it seems, in exchange for access and favors with the State Department. And so the implications of Mrs. Clinton becoming president, and then what will she do? What kind of access? Honestly, in any other time and place, this would be so extremely corrupt. No one would stand for this. It really is astounding, honestly. And as I understand it, in the polls right now, there are 6 points separating Donald Trump and Mrs. Clinton, with Mrs. Clinton prevailing. So I don't know, you know, who knows about the polls. And I'm not saying that I doubt that. I'm just saying who knows where they are and in which states, because it's all a big chess game. And I know it's close. That much we can be sure. And actually, we're going to talk today about voter fraud, because that is a huge concern. A close election will mean that the left can steal the election. They've done it before, and they certainly will do it again. At least they will try to do it again. So we're going to talk about that at great length with Hans von Spakovsky in just a little bit. But things have gotten very heated, but of course, between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. In fact, just a little bit of this. Trump was in Des Moines, Iowa, big, huge crowd. And this is what he said about Mrs. Clinton.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot who sees people of color only as votes, not as human beings worthy of a better future.
All right, so the point he's making, and he made it up in that up near Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago, He says the Hillary Clinton-backed policies are responsible for the problems in the inner cities today. And a vote for her is a vote for another generation of poverty, high crime, and lost opportunities. Democratic lawmakers have ruined the schools. They've driven out the jobs. They've tolerated a level of crime no American should consider acceptable. I'm asking for your vote so I can be your champion in the White House. That's what he said as he was addressing the black audience in Wisconsin. Kellyanne Conway, who was now his campaign manager, says now he is planning to go directly into African-American communities to make his pitch. So that'll be really interesting, no doubt. That'll be very interesting. Maybe Sheriff David Clark will go with him from Milwaukee, because that sounds like a speech that Sheriff Clark could have written. And so Hillary Clinton, of course, is not to be outdone in these kinds of accusations. So this is what she had to say about Donald Trump.
From the start, Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia. He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party.
Yeah, the radical fringe. Of course, she's talking about people like you and me. She's talking about Breitbart News. Steve Bannon is now working on the campaign for Donald Trump. And, of course, Breitbart is very much pro-legal immigration and anti-illegal immigration. And so that's just one outlet. Many people, I'd say AFA is for pro-legal immigration as well and against illegal immigration, because it's really bad for the country. You know, Donald Trump is right when he says if you don't have borders, you don't have a country. He's right about that. But of course, then the left, with Hillary Clinton leading the charge, translates that to bigotry and to race, prejudice against race. And so I tell you, because Americans have lost their ability to think critically, not everyone, certainly not everyone, but because we do, you know, campaigning and sound bites, and people don't know the layers behind, they don't have full understanding, then they're easily led to believe just really silly things about anybody. Anybody can be destroyed. Anybody can be puffed up who's not worthy of being puffed up. Think of, the Kardashians. We live in a fake, false time where it takes tremendous discernment and understanding to really ferret through all of this. And that's where, you know, American Family Radio comes in, because you need a source of information that you can trust. This is something I have to check myself on all the time. Certainly I have prejudices and very strong opinions that are just my opinions, and I don't mind sharing those, but my commitment is to sharing my opinions based on the facts, because sometimes your opinions don't line up with the facts. You have a preference or a druthers, you know, and maybe the facts don't line up with your particular whims or wishes, or they don't comport to your convenient views. And so that's why I do my best to bring to you what I believe is the truth. I can't tell you everything, and certainly I do eliminate stories or leave them out because I can't cover everything. But I really do try my best to bring you what I believe is true. So that's my pledge to you, is to bring you the truth on all these matters as best I can. Now, Mrs. Clinton is talking about Donald Trump being, hateful, all the rhetoric about minorities. But let me tell you about Mrs. Clinton. We know now that this week the 10,000th Syrian refugee has reached the shores of the United States. They are being located in California and Virginia, small towns. And, of course, the small towns have nothing to say about it. They just show up, and people have to provide for them. And, of course, these so-called Christian charities, Catholic charities, Lutherans, some Baptist, are making money hand over fist, federal dollars, your tax dollars, taking in and whatever they do. I'm giving, providing the conduit to bring all the benefits to all the people that are coming into the country. It's amazing. And according to the Center for Immigration Studies, if Mrs. Clinton is elected president, she could potentially add as many 10 million new immigrants to the U.S. during her first term alone, on top of the millions of illegal immigrants to whom she would grant immediate amnesty. I can't go into all the details. We should probably put that on our Facebook page. The title of it is Immigration Expert, U.S. to Resettle Nearly 1 Million Muslim Migrants Under One Term of the Clinton Presidency. And that's an article on Breitbart. I want to get into, I hope I have time today to get into this article on Human Abedin's mother is very connected with the Muslim Brotherhood. I've said this before. So is Huma. She's been with Hillary Clinton for really decades now. By the way, her husband's in the news again, Anthony Weiner, for doing more sexting. It's so disgusting that I'm not even going to repeat the details. Many people feel that it's a marriage of convenience. It's a strange and bizarre and maybe in some ways very perverse situation in ways you might not even imagine. So, but the Abedins are, Huma and her family, are very much Sharia law adherents. That means, trust me, they cannot be committed American citizens and embrace Sharia law. Can't be, won't happen. And so it's, I want to tell you that story a little bit more later in the show, I hope. But Donald Trump has been very controversial lately over what he said about immigration, whether it's, you know, we're going to build a wall, or whether he allegedly, supposedly, while I was gone, changed his mind. In fact, let's listen to cut four. This is the statement in which people felt he changed his mind.
We're going to obey the existing laws. Now, the existing laws are very strong. The existing laws, the first thing we're going to do, if and when I win, is we're going to get rid of all of the bad ones. We got gang members, we have killers, we have a lot of bad people that have to get out of this country. We're going to get them out, and the police know who they are. They're known by law enforcement who they are. We don't do anything. They go around killing people and hurting people, and they're going to be out of this country so fast your head will spin. We have existing laws that allow you to do that. As far as everybody else, we're going to go through the process.
All right, well, that's a little bit of what he has to say. He promises a speech on this soon, but related to that is a story out of Louisiana this morning. I'm sure all of you down there know the story of this bus that crashed, hit a firefighting vehicle that was blocking the road because of another accident, killed the fire chief in this little town, and killed another person, injured many people. The bus was filled with people volunteering to help people in the flood down there in Louisiana. I found myself wondering if it's any of our people. I don't know that. I haven't heard any description of that. But the driver of that bus was an illegal immigrant who didn't even have a driver's license. So this is why. If you can't speak English, you don't know the rules of the road, you don't understand the signs, this is the kind of danger that the left doesn't care about putting Americans in. And it's been going on for decades. It's really absolutely untenable. We have to get a grip on who can be legal and who is not legal in this country. And we do need to do something about it. I just think common sense and the preservation of our American citizens, which is the highest calling of the Commander-in-Chief, must be adhered to. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning, back right after this.
With a ministry opportunity, here's Steve Tiber of 8 Days of Hope.
$22 billion of damage occurred last year in October in South Carolina due to flooding. They saw rain that they had never seen. It was a 1,000-year flood. And now you and I get a chance to go with 8 Days of Hope this October to help hundreds of families rebuild their homes. 16,000 homes suffered some type of damage. We expect thousands of volunteers to come from around the country to southeastern South Carolina in October. We're looking for roofers and plumbers and electricians, people that know how to paint and hang drywall. There's something for everybody at 8 Days of Hope. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com.
Help us to be the hands and feet of Jesus. Sign up for at least 3 days between October 8th and 15th. And if you're not able to go, you can still help with a financial donation at 8daysofhope.com. That's 8daysofhope.com.
Last year, the AFR family provided enough funding to expand a children's home and orphanage for boys and girls in Southeast India. Well, thanks to your gifts, more children now have a safe place to go for shelter, nutritious meals, and hope for the future.
With my studies and with my strength, I can follow my dream.
Recently, the Indian government changed the building codes, requiring a completely separate building for boys, and they have to break ground on a new building by September 15th. Otherwise, they could be forced into a non-Christian facility where children like Sazkri couldn't have experienced a love that changed his life.
I felt God. When we ate, when we studied, I was happy because we were not alone.
Tomorrow, join AFR, and together, let's build room for more to keep young orphan boys in India in a safe, nurturing, Christ-loving children's home operated by India Partners. 1,000 AFR listeners making a gift of $148 will make it happen. Give today at AFR.net.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and commentary next. Truett McConnell University is training students to love the Lord, love the Word, love the Church, and love the lost. Scripture is the foundation for everything they do. It's who they are, preparing students not just for a career, but to fulfill God's high calling on their lives. Truett McConnell University offers a wide array of bachelor's programs, some online, and they also have an outstanding Master of Arts in Theology. So if you'd like to schedule a visit to Truett's campus in the North Georgia Mountains, visit truett.edu. I want to be upfront with you and admit I don't know anything about Pokemon, and I don't have a clue where he wants to go. I'm a child of the 80s. If you want to talk Donkey Kong or Tetris, I'm your guy. All that to say, this Pokemon Go craze has now become crazy. Some of these gamers seem to have lost their minds. A New Jersey man actually filed a lawsuit against the makers of Pokemon Go. He alleges the game is prompting players to trespass on private property. Imagine waking up and finding strangers in your backyard. Not cool. Then there's the Arizona couple who left their toddler at home alone so they could play virtual hide and seek. And in Winona, Minnesota, Pokemon players there desecrated a Veterans Memorial Park. Folks, there's a fine line between being a Pokemon fan and being a Pokemon punk. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We should carefully consider whether our election system, our election process, is critical infrastructure, like the financial sector, like the power grid.
In the wake of cyber hacks that infiltrated Democratic campaign computers, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson today announced that the Obama administration was conducting high-level discussions about election cybersecurity, an effort to both guard against cyber intrusions and to secure the voting process. While President Obama didn't come right out and blame the Russians for hacking the DNC or attempting to influence the U.S. election, he did make it clear that Washington is suspicious of Moscow, and for good reason.
There's certain things that states should not be doing to each other when it comes to cyber attacks.
Still, White House officials downplay the danger.
There are risks out there, but I think the American people can have quite a bit of confidence in our ability to mitigate those risks and to confront that threat.
Some suggest the alleged hack is just the latest example of an expanding Cold War redux, including Moscow's support for the Assad regime in Syria, Russia's incursion into Ukraine, and the repeated and provocative engagements of U.S. military vessels and aircraft.
Are we talking about a major world power trying to interfere with and have a disinformation campaign in the United States elections? If so, that's a really serious thing.
So serious, in fact, that the Obama administration now, Brett, has infrastructure in place that would enable them to pose, levy heavy fines, not just on individuals, but also on countries if they were found to be hacking U.S. systems. But experts continue to warn that levies and sanctions alone won't be nearly enough.
Sandy Rios back with you. I have to tell you, when I heard that report, it's been a few weeks since Kevin Cork brought that report on Fox, that the thing that went through my mind, because I don't trust anybody or anything anymore, I don't think, is, the chairman of the Department of Homeland Security is talking about voting booths being critical infrastructure and maybe, you know, controlling them. But, of course, it's all about Russians potentially hacking our elections, not about anything that might happen here. Well, I have to tell you that many people are worried about the 2016 election and potential voter fraud, and for good reason. And there's no one who knows more about that than our next guest. Hans von Spakovsky was with the Federal Elections Commission for a number of years. He is the senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's written so much about this whole issue of voter fraud. and I've asked him to join me this morning. Good morning, Hans. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. I hope you are too.
I am, Hans. It's good to be back home. Good to be back in the United States in spite of all the trouble. But seriously, I know this isn't what we were going to talk about this morning, but honestly, did any antenna go up with you when they start talking about voting booths being part of, you know, critical infrastructure?
Oh, yeah. Now, remember, this is the same White House that says there's no voter fraud in the United States. You know, they deny that voter fraud ever occurs, and yet suddenly they're saying, oh, we may need to designate as critical infrastructure the American election system. Now, what most people don't realize is that that's very pertinent language, because after 9/11, we passed this federal statute that allows the president or the Secretary of Homeland Security, if he does that designation, it means that the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department, the FBI, are given special authority to go in and try to thwart any potential terrorist or other activity or attacks on that critical infrastructure. And so this would give the Justice Department, for example, suddenly power over precincts and polling places all across the country, something they don't have right now. And listen, he was asked, that is Jay Johnson, he was specifically asked by one of the state secretaries of state, Tom Scheduler of Louisiana, whether they've got any evidence of any credible threat against our system, and Jay Johnson's answer was no.
So this really is, honestly, it just seems like, oh boy, the creepy laying of groundwork for something that could be really bad. Like, okay, I'm gonna step off the plank here. Let's say maybe the election ends up being really, really close, and because they've already laid the groundwork that Donald Trump is connected with Putin, their best buddies, according to he claimed he had a relationship with them, and the left claims that he has a really good relationship with them, and now they're inferring that the Russians may mess with the election. So, gee, if it's close, maybe it's probably the Russians then that are messing with our election apparatus, and so then the Justice Department and the executive branch come in to kind of fix it, right, Hans? Something like that?
Well, I wouldn't quite go so far as them blaming it on the Russians. I think it would be more of they would say, well, there's a potential for hacker attack, so Justice Department lawyers need to be present in polling places all across the country.
Oh, boy.
And those polling places, when those lawyers are there, remember, those lawyers aren't nonpartisan, unbiased government officials in white lab coats. All the people who work in the Civil Rights Division, those are the lawyers who'd be out there. They are virulent left-wing partisans. So they would be in the polling places, and they would be the ones coming out, particularly maybe in a state that's close, saying, we saw all kinds of voter suppression efforts going on in that precinct, in that area, and therefore that throws in doubt the results of the election if their favored candidate loses.
You know, this sort of makes me think of a same but different J. Christian Adams' account of what happened when the Justice Department, Civil Rights Division, went down to New Orleans to try to sort of bring the police department to account in New Orleans, and found out that one of those Justice Department officials was actually writing letters to the op-eds or letters to the editor or sending out things to damning of the police under a different name, just to demonstrate how not objective the Civil Rights Division is on these kinds of issues. So that's a danger of a whole different kind. But you actually this morning, or last Friday, I think it was a Thursday, wrote an article where you said, and I'm hoping, you said there was actually some good news in the voting process. What is that good news, Hans?
Well, we had this great, great decision from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was over this really ridiculous lawsuit that was filed against the state of Ohio. Ohio used to have 35 days of early voting, if you can imagine that, more than almost any state in the country. And it was a huge administrative burden. They decided to reduce it to 29 days, which still meant they had more early voting days than almost any other state. But they also got rid of same-day registration, which is a recipe for fraud. They were sued, and a lower court said, oh, you can't do that. Reducing your early voting time by 6 days and getting rid of same-day registration violates the Constitution and is discriminatory, if you can imagine that. Now, both of those are just really ridiculous claims, because you can look at the Constitution. You got a right to vote on Election Day, but you don't have any right to vote, you know, 10 days early or 20 days early or 30 days early. You know, states very recently have started allowing that. But the idea that that's a constitutional right or that it's discriminatory, other courts have said that. And fortunately, Sixth Circuit overturned that decision and said, no, you know, if a state wants to change its voting rules on things like that, that's not unconstitutional.
You know, Hans, the other part of this is that you write about, and because we've talked a lot about George Soros, you know, in the last few weeks, we've talked about him a lot anyway, but more intensely, when we have seen, you know, his email was hacked, and so we had more information about what they're actually doing. And you are reporting that this lawsuit was a Soros-funded lawsuit.
Oh, yeah. The Soros gave millions of dollars to this particular law firm in Washington, D.C. It's the Perkins Coie Law Firm. They have some very, very good lawyers there. But the main thing about this law firm is that they are the main Democratic Party law firm. They represent many, many Democratic officials, including, by the way, they are the lawyer for the Hillary Clinton campaign. So it's that law firm that has been filing lawsuits around the country, paid for by George Soros, to do things like challenge voter ID laws.
So it's a little confusing, as I know you know. We've had Texas has been in the news with their voter ID laws, and they sort of gave up on their strict voter ID law, did they not? Or where did that finally land?
Well, they fought really hard in court. They got some just atrociously bad decisions from the courts, including, unfortunately, from the Court of Appeals that covers Texas. So they didn't give up their right to appeal, but they managed to enter into a settlement with the U.S. Justice Department, an interim settlement, that said that for the November election, the ID law will be in place, and if someone shows up at the polling place who doesn't have a photo ID, they'll still be able to vote if they fill out a form in which they swear that they had some kind of reasonable impediment that kept them from getting an ID, and they show something like a utility bill, a bank statement, or a government document or paycheck that's got their name and address on it. That was about the best they could get, given the really slew of bad judges that they drew, including a recent Obama appointee.
And it certainly is the swing states that seem to be the focus of these kinds of lawsuits and these voter ID laws.
Oh, yeah.
So kind of break it down for us a little bit. Now, there are other issues besides, but let's talk about voter ID first. How many states have really good voter ID laws right now?
About a dozen states have good voter ID laws. The ones in Texas and North Carolina have been weakened or put in abeyance. Wisconsin also has a great voter ID law that is the subject of much controversy and two different lawsuits, also paid for and financed by George Soros.
But in addition to this whole business of voter ID and the danger of people voting, you know, multiple times, then you also have the whole issue that the pre-voting. So how many states are allowing these like 30 plus day, you know, voting ahead? How many states allow that?
About two-thirds of the states now allow some period of early voting. I think the median average that they allow is about 14 days. About a dozen states now allow same-day registration, which is where you can register and immediately vote There's no time for election officials to actually check that any of your registration information is correct or accurate, or that you're not lying on that in that information. But what the left is unhappy that they don't have same day registration in every state around the country, and that's why they're filing lawsuits against states that have thought better of it and are trying to get rid of it, like North Carolina and Ohio, because of all the problems it causes. Because they want to establish a rule, you know, that's just created by the court, saying, "Oh, it's unconstitutional, or it's a violation of the Voting Rights Act for you to get rid of same day registration once you put it in."
So they're doing. If you were to compare the state of the voting laws in 2008, when Barack Obama was first elected, and 2016, how would you compare them? Better or worse?
I think we're a little bit better, because a number of states since 2008 have put in voter ID laws, but the fights in the courts have gotten even worse. And the problem is that states are now putting in things that are going to make our problems exponentially worse, like California, Oregon, and others, who are putting in these automatic voter registration laws, which will automatically register people to vote from government databases, which, as you know, contain lots of people who aren't U.S. citizens, who may be felons, who may live in other states, and yet suddenly they're going to be registered to vote.
I always think of the irony, Hans, of when Barack Obama was a senator in Illinois, how he pushed the motor voter law. You know, he was one of the big voices, and that's where so much of this voter fraud started, not discerning whether people were citizens or not, allowing there's a huge window of opportunity to be registered to vote when you're not even a citizen. And I think that's what's, I'm sure there's been problems for decades, but that certainly made it worse. And now in Florida, we have an influx of something like a million Puerto Rican voters because of the financial problems on the island of Puerto Rico. That's a whole other twist, isn't it? Because they are citizens.
They are, and it's actually interesting and I think significant that you point that out about Barack Obama. I don't think a lot of people realize that, yeah, he was involved in suing the state of Illinois when the motor voter law was first passed. So it tells you how much he really understands that if his political party can manipulate the voting rules the way they want them manipulated, it may help them win elections, even though it leads to, and in fact, one of the purposes of manipulation is to make fraud easier to commit so they can win.
Hans von Spakovsky, one of the nation's leading experts really on voter fraud, will put his latest from Conservative Review. Conservatives score two voting law wins in Ohio and Virginia, but could those victories be short-lived? That's the title of it. It'll be on our Facebook page. And if you want to read more of what Hans has written, of course, you can just Google his name, and he's a, like a veritable encyclopedia. Hans, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, Sandy Rios in the morning.
Since I've led tours for many years to the Holy Land, Israel, many people ask me, what's your favorite place to go? I have two, really, the Garden Tomb and Calvary, and the Sea of Galilee. Now, I like all the places we stopped along the way in Israel, but those two places in particular are very special and meaningful. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We'll be going to all the places you've read about in the Bible since you were a child. It's going to be a very special tour of Israel, the Holy Land, March 9 through 17, 2017. We're taking a direct flight from New York to Tel Aviv. For all the information on this tour, just call us at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and leave us your name and your address, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, option 5, or visit the website twholyland.com.
Consider serving the Lord with Friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hey, dear family, it's Lauren. I would love you to join me 8 o'clock p.m. Central Time on Saturday nights on American Family Radio for my show, Living Life with Lauren. We interview authors, speakers, interesting people that have stories to tell that just make a difference in our life. It's time for us to come together, hang out, and decompress. I'd love to have your company every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central Time on American Family Radio.
In the book of Isaiah, the word tells us, the grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of our God endures forever. In the same way, without careful planning, your financial goals could blow away like the seeds of a dandelion. It's never too early or too late to consider how a charitable gift annuity can help you meet the financial goals you've set for your loved ones, your causes, and yourself. Give AFA Foundation a call at 800-326-4543, extension 345, or visit our website, afafoundation.net. Let us explain how a charitable gift annuity can help you achieve your goals. As we read in Proverbs, the plans of the diligent lead to profit. Our phone number again is 800-326-4543, extension 345, and our website is afafoundation.net.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. America has much to learn from Europe's disastrous decades-long accommodation of Islamic supremacists' mass migration and their increasing demands for preferential treatment. It has imperiled Western civilization there and serves as a powerful warning for us here, too. One lesson is to stop repeating the Europeans' practice of allowing jihadists to recruit in prison. The practical effect is simply to incubate more Islamists and inevitably to endanger public safety when they are set free. Britain's grappling with this threat, personified by a particularly toxic Sharia promoter named Anjem Chowdhury, who has finally been sentenced to hard time. He's going to be confined to a special jail within a jail so as to minimize his ability to do on the inside what he's done for far too long on the outside. Jihad in jail is a problem we better come to grips with, too. This is Frank Affney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
There was an incident in 2009 when Hillary Clinton, a Secretary of State, was traveling overseas in India, and one of her top longtime aides, Huma Abedin, realized she had a real crisis on her hands. She had left what she described as burn papers in the front seat of the car they were traveling in, and she was so concerned she sent an email to another Clinton aide, Laura Gelati, and said, "You need to take the burn papers from the front seat of the car and move them into the trunk for safekeeping." So you may be wondering, what are burn papers? Well, in the intelligence community, there's a term, burn bag. Burn bag is what you use to destroy classified information. So the lingo in those circles is burn papers is something that you would put in a burn bag, and that would be classified information. So this essentially looks like an example of what the FBI director described as extreme carelessness in the handling of this information. The State Department said today that it would be wrong to jump to the conclusion that burn papers was in fact a reference to classified information, and they referred to this manual, which is the State Department employee handbook called the Foreign Affairs Manual, saying that burn material could also be things like personally identifiable information, like a social security number or a date of birth. But it really is sort of beyond logic to think that Huma Abedin was traveling with papers in a car on a foreign trip that she wanted to have moved and described as burn documents because it was someone's phone number or date of birth. I mean, that just really belies common sense, I think, particularly in this case. Yeah.
Catherine Herridge giving, you know, her more of her great reporting. Boy, she is really a bulldog on information, and she does. I find Catherine to be very even-handed, you know. She actually didn't, in the early years that I knew Catherine, I don't think she was as dogged as she is now. I don't know how to explain this. Always a good reporter, but I think the more she's gotten into Benghazi and all of this stuff about the Clinton email, the more concerned she's personally become. That's at least my sense of it. I don't know it from conversations with her, but I just really sense she has a tremendous concern. So she stays on this. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Huma Abedin also in some of the Clinton email earlier, you know, discovered, read, whatever, and all the thousands that people have been going through, that Huma had left very sensitive information on the bed in their hotel room. And one of the emails, she asks for someone to please go back to the hotel. They left the door open to the room. Just go in and get that thing, that book with, I think it was Mrs. Clinton's schedule, actually, on the bed and bring it to me. So a pretty forgetful person, that's, I guess, one issue. And with this top secret information, this burn information, that's unbelievable, really. And you think about the way they carelessly handled the email, the top secret names of people that were helping the government and who were likely put in danger. And we know again about the Iranian nuclear scientist who was, we believe, helping us to know more about the Iranian development of nuclear weapons and was over here doing that. And he was not protected and went back to Iran and then was hung just about 2 weeks ago. So we know that this stuff actually has consequences. And by the way, that Iranian scientist was mentioned in the email. Now, we don't know if somebody from the Iranian government read Mrs. Clinton's email and that was the direct result. The hanging was the direct result. But we can assume and we can draw some pretty good lines between it and assume that it was so careless to mention him in that way in an unsecured server. So on and on that part goes. But I wanted to get to something I mentioned earlier because I find this really stunning. This is an article in the New York Post, and it's an expansion of what, again, I had mentioned, and I will mention again, that Huma Abedin and her family, her father is gone now, he's dead now, but they were very much, her father, her mother, her brother, and Huma herself, involved with the Muslim Brotherhood. Did you hear me? Involved with the Muslim Brotherhood. Stealth jihad, trying to destroy this country from within. That's out of their own mouths, out of their own pen. We found their brain trust, all their information, the nerve center of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Holy Land Foundation trial. The FBI found it. Of course, we haven't heard anything about it in a very long time because we're not allowed to criticize Islam. But at the time, let's see, I seem to remember, they said they were going to destroy our miserable house from within. And now Miss Abedin is with Mrs. Clinton, her right-hand person, her mother, part of this. Let me read this to you, and rather than me saying it, just let's see, maybe the New York Post will say it in a way that has more impact. Mrs. Clinton talks about Mrs. Clinton talking to a Saudi girls' school run by her top aide, Huma Abedin's anti-feminist mother, who is Saleha Abedin. Mrs. Abedin, let's see. See, Huma's mom edits the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, which has suggested that America had 9/11 coming to it because of sanctions and injustices the U.S. allegedly imposed in the Muslim world. The journal also opposed women's rights as un-Islamic, arguing that empowerment of women does more harm than benefit. But stay with me because it gets more detail. In 1999, Saleha, the mom of Huma, translated and edited a book entitled Women in Islam, A Discourse in Rights and Obligations, published by the Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs, written by her Saudi colleague Fatima Nassif. The book explains that the stoning and lashing of adulterers, the killing of apostates, sexual submissiveness, and even female genital mutilation are all permissible practices under Sharia law. It says circumcision for women is allowed. They say that laws promoting feminist equality don't work, and the only solution is Islam. It is the only escape. And forget about having, as a woman, a position of authority. Her job, it says, in quotes, her job would involve long hours of free mixing and social interaction with the opposite sex, which is forbidden in Islam. And certainly it is. Women have to stay at home with their faces covered. Black veils, they only can go out with permission. In fact, in strict Islamic cultures, they said that Islamic women only go out twice in their life, and that's once when they're born and once when they die. Certainly women get out on the streets in their veils now, but it's if you go to an Islamic Sharia adherent country, women are hidden in back rooms and they're not allowed to interact. So, this part of women's liberation she embraces. She writes, Lisa, she was editing a book that said women can also participate in fighting when jihad becomes an individual duty. Now, remember, this is the mother of Huma Abedin. So now here's the interesting part. Here's Mrs. Clinton's, this champion of women's rights, right? This feminist, this leader on the vanguard of, you know, cooperating with the Saudi Arabia and Huma's mom, bringing her mother in to speak at these big conferences, working together on the Organization of Islamic States. And by the way, 1995, according to the New York Post, less than 3 weeks before Clinton gave her famous women's rights speech in Beijing, Saliha headlined an unusual Washington conference organized by the Council on American Islamic Relations, that's CARE, to lobby against the UN platform drafted by Clinton and other feminists. Visibly angry, Huma's mother argued it runs counter to Islam and was a conspiracy against Muslims. Specifically, she called into question provisions in the platform that condemned domestic battery of women. Pakistan-born Saliha maintained that men who serially beat women tend to be unemployed, making their abuse somehow more understandable. And quote, they are victims of a different kind, she claimed, and they are simply taking their frustrations out on women. But that didn't stop Mrs. Clinton from forming a partnership with Saleh's Dar al-Hekma College, called the U.S.-Saudi Women's Forum on Social Entrepreneurship. And it goes on and on. I think, you know, if you look at the dollar signs, it could possibly be that the Clinton Foundation got a few dollars from the Saudi Arabia. Just saying. But this is dangerous stuff, ladies and gentlemen. This is very dangerous stuff. This is so very obvious, unrefutable. A person in the White House, in the State Department, and wherever Hillary Clinton has been, who has access to all of our most sensitive national security secrets, and her mother and her brother and herself involved with the Muslim Brotherhood. Just if there were no other connection, but we can make a lot more than that, it would be concerning. But that is just unbelievable. And you wonder why Mrs. Clinton wants to increase the influx of Muslim immigration near 500%? 500%? But let me go on with this. Trey Gowdy then went on last week. You may have heard this because I'm not exactly sure about the timeline, honestly, since I was gone. But Trey did an interview with Martha McCallum, I believe, and he talks about what more they've learned about Mrs. Clinton and how she handled her email. Let's skip to number 10, please.
Even listening to her talk about the Clinton Foundation, I couldn't help but go back and remember the press conference she gave on her emails, Martha, where every single thing she said proved to be false. That's the interesting thing about credibility and believability. You can't just keep it in one compartment. When you are a habitual serial liar in this facet of life, it tends to make people not believe you in other facets of life. So when she's talking about the Clinton Foundation, I go back and remember her saying, there's no classified information. I only use one device. I did it for convenience, all of which were proven to be false. Yeah. I hope somebody in your line of work will ask her, did you consider foundation emails to be personal or work-related? I have yet to see a single foundation email produced by the State Department that was sent by her. Yeah. So if she considered them to be personal, then we move into the facet where she and her lawyers had those emails deleted. And they didn't just push the delete button. They had them deleted where even God can't read them. They were using something called BleachBit. You don't use BleachBit for yoga emails or for bridesmaids emails. Mm-hmm. When you're using BleachBit, it is something you really do not want the world to see. So I hope someone in your line of work will ask her, did you consider foundation emails to be personal or work?
All right, so this is the most important thing, I think, of that Gowdy exchange, that Mrs. Clinton and her attorneys used this special technology called BleachBit to absolutely eradicate those email from her server. that she didn't want red. Bleach bit. I'd never heard of it. Maybe some of you techies have heard of it. But that's something that no one could recover. And Trey is just saying the obvious. If it's about yoga and your daughter's wedding, really? Your attorneys come in and they use this extreme measure so that no one could ever, ever see them, including you, ever? Not hardly. No one believes that. So Trey then goes on to talk about, Congressman Gotti goes on to talk about what he learned about the FBI investigation of Mrs. Clinton. And this is equally startling. Let's listen.
Well, I read every word of all of the witness interviews yesterday. And Martha, I'll tell you up front, there's no reason you should not be able to read a summary of that interview that I read yesterday. You and your viewers should be able to read everything that I read yesterday that related to the FBI investigation. There's no reason you should not. My takeaway was this. Remember, James Comey said she was not indicted because he didn't have sufficient evidence on the issue of intent. I didn't see any questions on the issue of intent. There's no question she handled them negligently or extremely carelessly. He said he didn't go forward with charges because she didn't have specific criminal intent. I didn't see any questions on that.
All right,
she said she did it for convenience, but I didn't see the follow-up questions in the interview I read. Well, there are two ways to do it. One is circumstantial evidence. The other is direct evidence. The direct evidence would be, Madam Secretary, why did you set up this email server this way? Why did you not take a state.gov email address? And her response was, and it always has been, convenience. And then that's when you press and say, well, what could be more convenient than just doing a state.gov email address? The labyrinthine effort that you made to create this separate server, that's what's inconvenient. I would then ask, why did you delete emails that you kept for a year and a half? Keep in mind, these personal emails, she didn't bother to delete them for a year and a half. It was the fall of 2014, a year and a half after she left the State Department, that she decided to start deleting emails. Why didn't you delete them the month you left? Why didn't you delete them 6 months after you left? And the other question they should have asked her is, Madam Secretary, why didn't you turn your emails over the day you left service?
You got to leave
why
it there.
Did you
I'm
hold
so
on to them for almost 2 years?
All right, so that was Trey Gowdy with Martha McCollum on Fox News. And I just hope and pray that the American people are listening. And I think when this scandal over the email first broke, people didn't comprehend. It's email. It's we all have, you know, who wants to have other people read their email? It seems so innocuous. But now I think if people are listening, they're understanding the dangers and what she's actually done and selling favors and selling access to foreign governments, enriching herself and her family in the process. It really is very shocking. All right, Sandy Rios, back with you. We'll be back tomorrow. I think tomorrow we're going to be talking about the turning over of the internet to the UN. It's another amazing story. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.